Okay, today is, okay, I'm terrible with dates. Today is August 22nd, 2012. This is an interview with Roger Whitmer. We are here in Memorial Library on the third floor inside the administrative suite. My name is Troy Reeves with the UW-Madison Oral History Program. Also here is Mike Lawler from the Wisconsin Story Project. Roger, to help us with sound quality, could you say your name first and last and then spell your last name?
Roger Whitmer, W-H-I-T-M-E-R.
Perfect. Okay, now I'm going to hit. So, Roger, first off, thanks for agreeing to meet us today.
We do
appreciate it. First question doesn't necessarily have anything to do with UW-Madison or the Sterling Hall bombing, but if you could provide a little bit of context to your early years, you know, where you grew up, what your parents did, sort of get us to the point of coming to UW-Madison.
Oh, okay. I grew up on a farm 12 miles west of Beaver Dam, and my father was an agricultural engineer for Green Giant Corporation, and he had an 80-acre farm, and I had three brothers, and so that was our job, the farm. And a lot of families lived like that. Came to Madison in 1963 and was a physics major.
Okay. Well, why did you choose to come to, I guess at that point it was UW, not UW-Madison. Why did you decide to come to UW?
Well, I didn't have to take an entrance exam because the Wisconsin idea was that the boundaries of the state were also the boundaries of the campus, so they let us all in no matter what our preparation was. Very progressive that way. And it was closest to home, and we were cheap. I paid my way through college with farm labor jobs, like a lot of other folks at that time.
Did you have an interest in physics in high school?
Yes.
So when you came here, did you intend to major in?
Well, it was actually a joint major, physics astronomy. But okay. Yeah, my interest was astronomy.
Could you talk a little bit about your first days here on campus? Any, you know, stories that might stand out about acclimating to?
I picked Elm Drive C, which is so far out into the wilderness by Picnic Point that there was an Indian burial mound behind the building. And so it was a 45-minute walk to class and back. And the campus had a lot of energy at that time. It was crazy, and there was a non-political riot within 6 weeks. We rolled a giant snowball onto a two-wheel cart from the ag school and then delivered that to the middle of University Avenue to block traffic. Who knows why, you know? I mean, it was just...
Was there libation involved, or was it just?
I'm sure there was. There's not a lot of that going on at the dorm. We were a long ways from the bars, which probably saved a lot of folks at that time. But there's very minimal supervision at that time, and I'm not really sure. There's just people outside. It started with a snowball fight between dorms, and then it just swelled up from there. So
I'll have to check the records and see if we can find the history of the big snowball.
The police were eventually involved, and so yes, it's probably on the Madison police records.
So you came here in the fall of 63?
Right.
So soon after that, of course, was the assassination of John F. Kennedy.
Yes.
Do you have memories of your personal memories of
that? I was in the dorm. I think everybody in the United States remembers where they were when they heard that information. And believe me, that was really quite a shock to the entire country, and a fair amount of discussion about that.
Now, when you came here in the fall of 63, did you consider yourself political, and if so, what was your leanings?
No, not at all. I was pretty ignorant. It was impolite in my family to discuss anything involving politics, religion, money, you know, any life planning skills. So I would say I was right-winged because I'd stumbled into a Barry Goldwater book first, and political tracts are written in an easy-to-read, compelling style. And then by my sophomore year, I went the other way because I think there was some military action in the Caribbean on the part of the United States, and the government was lying about it at the time. CBS interviewed the actual soldiers themselves, and they had taken sides in a civil war. and the official policy was that we were not. I began to doubt everything I heard from the government at that point, and there was plenty of folks around to point out some of the problems with the war in Vietnam. Was the Gulf of Tonkin incident, I think, was one of the things, and a few others, and it didn't really make sense. Mm-hmm. But the campus had, at that time, it seemed like almost 30% of the students came from out of state. And there were large luxury dorms in the Langdon Street area, some of which have been converted to university property. And there was a fair number of activist folks. So there were political rallies, and us Wisconsin people would go to those just out of entertainment, and because that's something I'd never heard before. And I did not figure out how the civil rights works, what civil disobedience really means, in terms of in a sense, it looked like, looking back, it looked like folks were sacrificing their health, doing something slightly illegal to bring the press out, to get a message into the newspapers and into the press that they couldn't do otherwise. I mean, that's my simple-minded interpretation of Gandhi and Martin Luther King. This is a retrospective mm-hmm. for me. At the time, I had not figured it out because the political folks from the East Coast were pretty righteous. And that civil rights, I mean, the anti-war movement, and Paul Sagan, I think, has stated this publicly, the anti-war movement borrowed the tactics from the civil rights. And so this went on in the background. I mean, I think the Freedom Riders started in the 50s or 60s, and that's an extremely brave group of people, and I was utterly clueless about that. So it was called being radicalized at the time. Students come to campus and are exposed then to anti-authoritarian messages. And the hippie thing hadn't quite got started. It's fun to look at the pictures from the student movement in the early 60s. Everybody is very clean-cut looking, and it changed rather quickly. I think for a lot of us, and I talked to my younger brother about this, the political demonstrations were a break, an excuse to not study, a break from the tedium of dorm life. It was not that much different from the tailgating that takes place before a football game for some of these folks. And it escalated. You know, there were huge movements. There were student protests that were so large that they lost control of themselves and break into two groups. I think 15,000 people, perhaps 10,000 going down University Avenue, and one half breaks off and goes up State Street and around the Capitol, and the other half doesn't even know that. You know, they had walkie-talkies and a few things like that at the time. So this was, if nothing else, this was extremely theatrical.
How involved in this stuff were you at all, if at all?
I felt intrigued by all the questions. I doubted the government, and I was alienated by the righteousness and the attitude of the people from the East Coast, because I just didn't get it. I didn't understand at that time the civil rights, the civil disobedience process, and I've seen things. You know, I saw the movie Gandhi, and it all fell into place. Okay, this is what they're doing. And when we saw Madison police officers interviewed on television, they didn't get it either, because they're the ones that had to do the dirty work, had to deal with this stuff. And it's one thing to have some Quakers with some placards and signs and so on, and then you load them into the paddy wagon and they go. And it's another thing to have, you know, the students that will push back. And one of the things I noticed, I think in 1968 or 69, when there was a description in the newspaper of the anti-war riot near the stadium, that all the males who were arrested had, in addition to trespassing, were also busted for resisting arrest, had Irish names. So there was one group of people that had not, I don't know if they must have come from, well, I don't know where they came from. They did not enjoy being manhandled by the Madison police, you know, and we would hear stories. And the hippie arts explosion started, you know, in 66 and 67. So there were times, I remember sitting on the Union Terrace listening to a rock and roll band, and if we chose, we could walk down Park Street to University Avenue and take part in a protest. I mean, you had your choice, you know, do you sit on the terrace and listen to subversive rock, we thought it was subversive rock and roll, or do you go tip a police car over, you know, it went on, and starting in the early 60s, it just continued. I think even after I'd moved out to Poinette, there were times when I would come and pick somebody up, or I would leave, or we'd worry about having tear gas in the car. We'd have to ventilate the car, even though it was parked somewhere on campus, or, you know, away from campus. You'd have to worry about, you know, what it's like a weather report and then the political activity report, and where you're going to park your car, and how are you going to avoid the being downwind of the tear gas and get that out of your car as you drive home.
So just to get some clarity on some specifics, what year did you graduate?
I should have graduated in 67. I graduated in 69. So
okay. And when did you move to Poinette?
September of 1970.
Okay. So after you had graduated, I see.
Right.
And actually after Sterling, right after Sterling
Hall. Right after Sterling Hall.
Okay.
And that was already planned. It just happened that way.
So was there ever a point between 63 and 70 where you became more radicalized or became more involved or sympathetic to what was going on in the anti-war movement?
I think that by the time I had gotten to my junior year, my roommate and I had a lot of political discussions about this, because the story from the U.S. government did not make sense. And none of us could figure out, and still can't figure out, just exactly how Vietnam was a threat to the to us as a country. What's going on here? And people would speculate, okay, you know, there's oil drilling rights off the coast or something. There's, you know, there's mineral rights out there that are going to be protected or exploited in the future. And I was aware that the United States had no backing from any other foreign country except Australia for this activity. And I thought that was significant by contrast to the Korean War. And I was old enough to remember the Korean War as a child. So this didn't make sense. It seemed like a paranoid unilateral action on the part of the United States. And I guess I'd come to that conclusion by the time I was a junior. But I still didn't understand how the mechanism of civil rights worked. It simply seemed to me that you spoke truth to power the way a June bug talks to a windshield of an automobile. I mean, that you'd go out there and get beat up, and so what? I did not realize that the presence of the press and a clear message is the most significant part of that process. And I hadn't, you know, no one had explained that to me. I did not have these discussions, and it wasn't until I saw the movie on Gandhi in the 80s, where some of his activities, the press didn't show up, and it was a disaster for the folks who were there. You know, they sacrificed their health and got beat up by the police for nothing. Mm-hmm. So I understand that process, and I've met people who've had gone to demonstrations somewhere, and there was like a more exciting demonstration someplace else, and all the press went over there. So they didn't get beat up, but they would picket some military institution, and essentially they're just working in a vacuum, and nobody knew about it. And at the end of the day, they all got in their cars and went home, you know, and just annoyed a few workers trying to come and go. Mm.
You can go ahead.
I'm just going to skip ahead just for a minute since we're on the subject. So Sterling Hall has happened. You've lived through that. Any change of attitude or anything based on that event? I mean, either way, whether you were even less understanding of the anti-war movement, or was it mean, where did you fall then?
I thought that it's legitimate to ask the university about where they get their money and what they're doing and what parts of the government they're working for, that there is a difference between the National Institute of Health and defense spending. I'm also aware that since then that all universities rely very heavily on government funding, exclusively, you know, and especially if they're research oriented, like the University of Wisconsin. And the world of physics straddles both areas. There can be breakthroughs in physics that someone will hopefully invent, for example, an extremely effective automobile battery, and it'll change the nature of our transportation and pollution history in this country. But the same technology can use both ways. And that's a difficult situation. I mean, because I left here in 79 to work for General Electric, and it was called Aerospace and Defense. And the aerospace, they didn't tell me this during the interview, they talked in the interview about the fact that they'd put the gyroscopes into the very first orbiting observatory, first satellite observatory. It was proposed by the astronomy department here in Wisconsin. And it was launched, and it was reasonably successful, getting beyond the atmosphere with these. And I'm not sure how long it lasted. I was up there for 3 or 4 years. And the people that interviewed me at General Electric had actually built the gyroscopes that kept that thing stabilized and operated. While I was there, I was a star tracker engineer, and we would propose star trackers for other research satellites. But the rest of the company was not interested, because you build one or two, you take a risk, you might lose money, you gain prestige. And they backed out of aerospace work and became 100% defense. And I had no ability to steer it from that direction. And it becomes then an enormous gray area. You know, you meet with people that want to shut down the entire military operations of the United States, or do you spend your time worrying about how they're deployed? Mm-hmm. And you have these discussions. I had two brothers that were in Vietnam. One of them had two tours of duty. And if I had to encapsulate my attitude towards the soldiers that served in Vietnam, I think of them as firemen that would rush into an empty building thinking that there are people inside that need to be saved. Mm-hmm. And there may or may not be, and some of them may not make it back out. And I might even go one step further and think that part of the time the authorities might know that the building is empty and still let them go ahead and do it. I mean, the whole country had a change about Vietnam in retrospect. But no one still can answer the fundamental question, where was the threat to the United States on that basis? So being in physics, I became an optical engineer, and working for defense, I see both sides of the issue. I don't know if this answers your question, but Armstrong had choices. That you could get into that building with a credit card. The door had a gap of about a quarter of an inch, and it was a sliding bolt. And there were times when I had forgot my key and could still get into the building. He could have gotten into that building and into locked doors just outside the two floors that represented the Army Math Research Center. I can understand selecting the Army Math Research Center as a target. We're protesting the war, but we can't get to the Pentagon so easily. We can't, you know, Baraboo Ordnance Works was one of their symbolic targets. I don't really know, you know, how thorough those guys were, you know, or what their background was. I do not know. I mean, I thought at that time the campus had become so polarized that there was simply symbolic thinking on the parts of both sides. And Baraboo Ordnance Works as a target just because it's the government and it's defense related. And at the same time, you'd meet people who took part-time jobs up there in the summertime to pay for their education, and they didn't support the war either. It's an interesting situation and confusing.
Mm-hmm. Well, Roger, there's a lot more things we want to ask, but I think to make sure we let you speak about it as much as you want, and if we have questions about it, I think we probably, let's talk about Sterling Hall right now.
Okay.
Well, you, no, you can back up to the sequence you had in mind. I'm okay with that.
I think, you know, Mike and I have a tendency to jump around all over the place anyway, so.
That's okay.
So, if you don't mind, if you would talk about that night.
Sure.
And, you know, as much as you want to talk, in as much depth as you want to talk about it, and then we may follow up specifically on that.
I think actually my first question would be, I know that you were a lab technician, but if
yes.
you can kind of talk a little bit about why you were there, mm-hmm. you know, what your job was, how long you've been doing that, and that kind of thing.
Oh, yeah, I'm not really sure exactly when I started. I may have been there 4 or 5 months. And I had the graveyard shift from midnight until 8 o'clock in the morning. So then the students don't want that. So I was a non-student, and so that that fit my schedule. Except I'd have to leave the party at 11:30 and go over there and go to work. You know, but I don't know if you've seen the layout of the facility. I don't know if it's still there, in fact, you know, but it is sort of an L-shaped room, and at one end of the L was the loading dock, and it was the ramp to that loading dock is where he parked the van. Mm-hmm. So that van had an abutment on one side, this concrete wall and ground, you know, so in terms of damaging the building, that's a smart place to do it, because all the blast will go into the building from that location. Part of the apparatus, it was analog, not controlled by computers, and so there were dials and knobs and so on, and someone has to babysit that stuff. It was, a 7 or 8 million volt machine, so the vacuum beam line had particles moving with twice that 14 million volts energy. So at one end of the L was what you'd call a source. It'd start you start with a hot filament and you bleed gas into it and you do things to it until you wind up with argon or something that has a couple of extra electrons attached to it. And that would accelerate down this huge tank. It was like a silo on its side, and perhaps not as tall, with insulating gas around it. In the middle of that tank at 8 million volts, all of a sudden it would lose those electrons, develop a positive charge and get shot back out the other side. So that's how they doubled the energy of the beam. Beam would go through a 90 degree magnet. It's kind of like a prism for light that would separate out a very narrow band of energies. Then it would go through a vacuum line. It would go through a wall and hit a target. So there'd be a room full of all the detectors and sensors, and this resembles a little bit what you saw about the Higgs boson when you saw pictures and things are spinning and moving and so on. So they would hit a target, usually a thin metal foil or something like that, and at different angles, particles would come out of the back of that at different energies, and they would use that information to reconstruct, you know, how that foil is actually assembled. There's a lot of data collection. It was automated. That was the analog side of the room. That's where the physicist doing, the grad student sat doing his research, and he would collect all this stuff and would monitor these things. So they always had an extra warm body there to watch the dials. Generally it was set up in the daytime and it was running smoothly, and it was a fairly mature technology, and the physicists we had on campus at that time, very, very skilled folks. You know, had worked on the Manhattan Project and come back here, some of them, and so this was a stable and successful operation. And I think that they're at that time for getting a PhD in physics. I think this was a fairly effective program for those guys. I didn't know Schuster very well. He was all business. He introduced himself to me, and he sat with his back to me, and I sat at my side of the room reading magazines and so on. I left my Renaissance lute in the car at the time, and my roommate's Renaissance lute. So I wasn't playing guitar or something like that, contrary to some of the things you may have read in the literature. We would occasionally, if there's extra people, we'd have big fat philosophical discussions with the physicists, but not that night. So Schuster was all business and pretty quiet. At around 4 o'clock, I would go out. I was in the middle of my break. I'd go to the other end of the building and buy some junk food out of a vending machine and then come back. So he said something to me at about 3:40 or so, that he was going out of the room. And I was waiting for him to come back when the explosion occurred. And this made the grand jury laugh, but my first thought was that we had a tank spark. If you have an 8 million volt spark inside a giant metal tank, I think I heard Professor Herb describe that as about a quarter stick of dynamite going off. And then inside a tank, it makes a tremendous noise as well. And sometimes those tank sparks would shut the lights off temporarily. And we had emergency lighting. So that's my first reaction. And I walk around this bank of instruments in this room. It's sort of in the center of the L, sort of in the elbow of this L-shaped thing, a triangular shaped room. And there's just all this dust in the air. And I go looking for Schuster, and I can't find him in the room where all of his apparatus is, behind his bank of instruments. In his room where all the apparatus is, he's not in there fixing something. And then there's a storage room, he was not in there. And I went around into the room where the stuff I control, where the what they call the source is. And it was nothing but swirling dust and smoke, and I saw things burning. So I came back. I knew that there was a fire extinguisher on the wall behind me. The wall was gone. And then I tried to go out into the hall, and I opened that door. So this is the main hall underneath what you see as the building, because all the rest of this is underground, mm-hmm. and surrounded by thick concrete so that we don't radiate the people walking by. So it was a bunker. It was naturally a bunker because of that radiation shielding. I opened the door to the hall, and I see nothing but debris, broken concrete blocks. I can't see anything through the dust, and there's a lot of electrical sparks, and there's water coming in rather quickly. It was up to my ankles by that time. I couldn't find Schuster. I went into these other rooms, and I went back into this source room to see what happened to the fire, and at that point in time, someone called my name, and it was Dr. Paul Quinn. So I think that was about 15 minutes, because he, from what he told me, he'd been blown out of his chair. He was up on the first floor. I was in the basement. He'd left his door open to his office. Otherwise, he would have been hit by the door, because the offices are small enough that, you know, that his desk faced the entrance door and it would have come right across. He happened to have left it open. The blast knocked him out of his chair. He may have been unconscious briefly, or not at all, or just disoriented. I'm not sure. I know you folks have talked to him, and I think he got cut climbing through the broken window behind him, and then he went around the building, around that end of the building, and around to the entrance.
He went outside the building. Is that what you're saying?
Paul went outside the building, and then looped around it, and then however long that took him was the amount of time I was inside. So I looked to my right, which I could have done the first time I was in that room. I guess there was too much smoke and debris, and there's just this ramp of debris and dirt, and I just walked out of that building towards these automobiles that you saw in the picture and towards the chemistry building. It was disorganized. There was one police officer there. I hung around for a while. It seemed disorganized to me, you know? Hung around, as you'd expect. a few physics professors showed up and they started asking for names. So I mentioned names that I'd heard from other people that may or may not have been seen that night in the building. Now, most of those folks had gone home and they were okay. I went home, you know, this was like 5 in the morning, slept for a few hours, and then I came back. And by then they had cordoned it off and they were willing to talk to people. I was able to get inside the first ring, and then I think I introduced myself either to a representative of the university or part of the Madison Police Department as willing to be a witness or make a statement or supply information that would help, and then was in a waiting room, and then I for a while, then I talked to Detective Lowen.
So,
quickly, so you said you didn't know Schuster, but you must have known Quinn, or he must have known you well enough because he asked for you by name. Did you have a...
Yes. I had met him when I first came to interview for this position. I think I was waiting in Professor Haberle's office, and Paul came by and said, you know, that's... He thought I was an undergraduate. He said, you know, that's not proper for you to be in there. If Haberle's teaching a course, you could be in there cribbing the answers for the exam or something. And I had to let him know I wasn't a student, you know. So, yeah, he was a friendly guy. He was from New York. He was a postdoc here, I think. And I don't know if he's still with the University of Wisconsin or not.
He is, yeah. We actually haven't interviewed Paul Quinn.
Oh, okay. I don't want to put words in his mouth.
Right.
This is what this is my memory from long time ago. And
Mike, what are you?
So when did you have an opportunity to tell anybody that you thought that David Schuster was in the building?
Yes, I did. I did list his name. That would have been the very first time I was there when I gave a list of names. That was the one name that was probably correct out of the list that I had, that I hadn't seen Schuster, and I had been looking for him.
Okay. Do you remember telling that to, you said there were some physics profs that were congregated. Is that who you talked to first, or what did you actually, do you recall, was it a cop, was it?
I think it was Professor Heinz Barshall that I gave a list of names to. Okay. And I think Schuster would have been among that. And then there's another gentleman, I remember his face, but I'm drawing a blank on his name, another professor.
Well, I think it was Barshall who was very adamant to the fire department that there was still, that Schuster was still in there.
Okay.
So this was probably after you had, I don't know why this is amazing to me, but it sounds, to me it's amazing that, you know, you get out, you go home, you rest for a bit. It's like, I would expect that somebody would have asked, you know, tried to get you into the hospital at least to check you out. And I'm not saying this is a slight to you. I'm just saying that it just, in my mind.
There was Paul Quinn and one police officer, and that was it.
Okay.
When you first came out.
Yes.
Yeah.
And I didn't know what to do. Well, I was gonna.
And you were not injured at all?
No, I don't think so. I'd have to say no. Maybe muddy, maybe wet feet or something like that, you know, but that's about it.
So, what about, I mean, you seem, you know, it seems very, in a way it reminds me of our interview with David Schuster, and your experience is a lot different than David Schuster's, but he was very calm and very matter of fact about what happened to him, even though he was buried up to his neck in rubble and didn't know if he was going to live or die. Still, his recollections are very matter of fact, and this is what happened, this is what I did. I guess what I'm curious about is what was going on in your mind. Were you thinking about what had happened, or what could have happened, or what could have happened to you, or what could have happened to other people, or?
I think, you know, if you see someone, you know, he had a member of the family that survived unscathed from a car wreck that totaled his car, you know, flipped end over end on a highway. you don't have any time to worry. It's like, boom, it happens, and then boom, I'm okay. And it is not, I would not begin to compare my situation to that of my brothers, for example, who know that they're facing danger, or even a police officer who goes out on a beat knowing that there's some small odds that something violent could happen. You know, it is not like that at all. It's ordinary life. Something really strange happens. But you know that you're okay at the end of it. And my biggest, you know, the strongest emotion, looking back on this whole thing, and it is not political, what bothers me the most is that 4 days earlier I'd been sitting on the Union Terrace, and for the first time, being a mechanical nerd, you know, I pay attention to this stuff. For the first time in my life, I saw a double stroller. I'd never seen one of those before. It was this little side-by-side stroller. And there are these two little babies in there, and either the babies or the older brother had bright red hair, carrot top. And it was this very lovely family. You know, they were tall, good-looking people. And the mom was good-looking, and the dad was this tall guy with slightly reddish hair, or blonde reddish hair. And they were, this family had an outing to go have breakfast on the terrace or something like that, about 10 in the morning. And the father looked just absolutely exhausted, looked like final exam time, you know, like she'd gotten him out of bed to get him out there to be with the family. But it was the red hair and the double stroller that made me remember this family. Well, 4 days later, he's dead. That was David Fosnock. And so I'm very conscious that this, I mean, that this beautiful family was destroyed by this act. And I'm also conscious or remember the fact that Fosnock, and this was explained to me by other people, I never saw Fosnock. I mean, he was in his lab doing his research. The windows of his lab were totally covered with aluminum foil. It was completely black in there. So there's no way the bombers could have known that room was occupied at 4 o'clock in the morning. He was doing research in superconductivity, and I think that his apparatus was being messed up by vibrations coming through the ground. And so he's looking for times when University Avenue had zero traffic to take his data, and that's why he was there at that time of day. It's taking its toll on his health too. I mean, and so that's, it's, I don't know if you'd call it survivor's guilt. I mean, I wonder why him and not me, you know. And they had also had told me that Schuster was actually closer to the truck than Fosnock was. And I had been told that the way the building was constructed, they had cinder blocks filling in, you know, they had columns and cement columns and girders and so on, and then in between spaces was cinder block, and then in the cinder block were the windows and stuff like that. And I don't know if it's true or not, but I had been told that Fosnock simply got hit in the face by a cinder block as it blew into the room and was killed instantly. So the irony is that Schuster was closer. The other irony is that if had the bomb gone off 1 or 2 minutes later, I would have been in the hall instead of Schuster. I was just waiting for him to come in the door to make my junk food run. And you know, so it's that timing more than the geography that makes me wonder about this. And then as with all terrorist activities, I guess, you know, in terms of innocent civilians, you know, that pay for this with their lives. No one, of course, used the word terrorism to describe this event at that time. And it was another 25 years before there was a domestic bombing in the United States, and then that was huge in Tulsa, Oklahoma. Mm-hmm. As you know, there are two books written on this. Mm-hmm. You've probably seen them both. Yes,
I've read them both.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So did you ever get to talk to Schuster in the aftermath?
No. I did not. He was in the hospital. I'd always felt that there was a separation. I had my own issues with the research and the faculty versus those of us who spent 6 years stumbling along. You know, I had low grades. You know, I was willing, you know, to work as a technician, but I had effectively given up on any thought of technology as a job at the time.
What about Quinn? Did you?
I mean,
you saw him obviously in the immediate aftermath, but.
No, I did not see him. I left town, moved out to Poinette. It could have been just the end of the month or something like that. And so I was not hanging around the sidewalks talking to reporters. I mean, I guess the town, you know, there were conversations and eyewitness accounts and that and all sorts of discussion going on, and I was just totally out of the loop in terms of that sort of casual conversation. What I do remember were some of the very disturbing, simplistic remarks made by people supporting the war. This is a good thing, it brings the war home. That was one of the slogans, bring the war home. Mm-hmm. And that was part of the rationalization, you know, for this destruction of property and that sort of thing. And that's where I think that they began to stray from the civil disobedience tactic of using civil disobedience to get a message into the press. But again, like I say, I didn't figure that out until the 1980s and I saw the history of Gandhi. Mm-hmm.
Could you talk about your memories of, you said you came back later that morning and you eventually got in front of, or he got in front of you, Detective Lilling. Could you talk a little bit about your memories of that?
Yes, we waited in a room. There were, I would say, 2/3 of the people in the room seemed happy about this event. It was really strange. They're like undergraduates have been pulled off the street. The Isthmus magazine. That's not the right magazine. There was a radical magazine published at that time. We were talking about the people sitting around with their Kroger store grins. You know that the Kroger store had been burned down on University Avenue a few months earlier.
In the Kaleidoscope or Takeover.
Right, probably Takeover, yeah.
I think Takeover was after Kaleidoscope.
But it could have been Kaleidoscope. And so there was all this cheerful gabble going on, and then there was a grad student who knew, I didn't know Schuster's name, I didn't know that it was Schuster I had seen at that time on the terrace. There was a grad student.
Sorry, you mean Fosnack.
Fosnack, I keep making that mistake. Yeah, there was a grad student who knew Fosnack and knew about his family, and this man lost it and started crying in this waiting room because of the loss of his family. And then, to my perplexity, a policeman told him to shut up. But that dampened the spirits of all the, let's burn the Kroger store again people or whoever they were. I don't know what else to call them. So there seemed like a lot of, this was a very symbolic act at a time in an extremely polarized social situation in the United States, and I think it took a lot of people to come to a final decision about this. So you heard dumb stuff, you know, this brings the war home, this is a good thing, and other people were horrified that someone had been killed. And it put a tremendous damper on the anti-war, I thought, you know, anti-war activity. In Madison, it undermined the moral authority of the anti-war movement, at least locally. What would be my summary judgment? Lulling had an FBI investigator there with me.
And so, did Lulling and the FBI investigator both question you?
The FBI investigator simply introduced himself. Detective Lulling asked all the questions, and they were not focused on anything very much at all.
It seems to me that from the police report, from that interview, that they were almost treating you like you were a suspect.
Yes.
Do you remember that?
Yes. No, there's a reason for that. I had a felony conviction for selling hashish, and I told him that right out front, you know, because he'd find out later anyway. And so his reaction is, "Would you roll up your sleeves and let me look at your arms?" He wanted to see if I was a heroin addict. So, mm-hmm. Now, how that would motivate me to almost kill myself blowing up, I don't know what his thinking was, but it was casting a really wide net at that time.
Sure.
And that's understandable. In the books that have been written about Lulling, he comes off as being pretty effective, and maybe he was. He was just getting started. This was like 2 years, they got him out of bed. This is like a 2 hour old investigation. So he was listening to everything and anything that would come along. But that's interesting that from their perspective, I was treated as a suspect.
Well, that's my impression. I mean, I have, a copy of the one sheet notes that a detective made of that interview with you, and it looks to me like they talk about the fact that you have a key, that you're on probation, that
all, right.
and all of this stuff. And it seems to me that although the questions aren't, there's no transcript, but it seems like they were definitely mm-hmm. trying to weed you out as a suspect.
Because, right, that's probably right.
So was moving to Poinette, was that going to happen before Sterling Hall?
Yes. Oh yeah, that was in the cards.
I guess in my dime store psychology, do you think having what you just went through, you think moving to Poinette was helpful or perhaps not helpful in terms of your processing this?
I think it was helpful in a sense because I didn't have to listen to all the dumb conversation. Like I said, the country was extremely polarized and there's a lot of symbolic thinking, and you had a political movement put together by 20-year-olds. That's a bad combination. And you had people like me that didn't even understand the mechanics behind the civil rights movement and civil disobedience. So there's a lot of inflammatory talk, kill the pigs, all the rest of this stuff that's going on. You don't want to hear that, when you get hit in the face with a bucket of cold water or a situation like this. And so that kept all that at arm's length in a way. And so, yes, I think that helped. I could have worked full-time helping to rebuild the place. I worked one day and it was just too depressing to be there. And they didn't question me on this. They simply paid me for my 8 hours and did not pester me to have me come back. Because the physics department rebuilt that facility in a matter of months and had it operating again, I think, by December or something like that. And so I missed an opportunity. Later on, I would go to work. We have a local firm, National Electrostatics Corporation, that builds what you'd call an atom smasher. So there was a spin-off industry actually from the skill of the University of Wisconsin in putting these together, and I think they're still in existence out in Middleton. And I wound up working there later, and I realized once I got there that had I gone back to Sterling Hall, I would have learned all kinds of vacuum technology. I was already sort of a machinist. I had done that as an undergraduate. But the other specialty for this stuff is high voltage electronics. Electronics can take a spark and keep on working and so on. There's like very specific, physics labs have very unique and specific skills for people, and it's just gone on from there in terms of massive computers and lasers and all kinds of things. But that would have been an educational opportunity for me that I missed. In retrospect, but
what was depressing about it? The memory of it, or what?
I think about the Fosnack family. Yeah. I think about the readjustment that they had to make, and the essence of the anti-war movement is symbolic acts to get the message. And I think of how they botched that, and they could have damaged the Army Math Research Center far more directly. I think the Army Math Research Center lost a Xerox machine or something like that. And then, of course, there's the windows blown out and all that debris to be cleaned up. But they did not do, other than that loss of a machine, it was just overhead account. All the researchers did their work at home, and they would come in once in a while for meetings or something like that. It was primarily mathematical kind of research, and they're working from home. Carlton could have gotten into that building. I mean, in the books they talk about the heat tunnels, He was not a student. The heat tunnels were used by fraternity boys for parties and things like that. I mean, you could enter those right here off of Park Street if you wished, you know. So I don't know if Carlton was reacting to rumors or not. Carlton could have easily have gotten into that building. There was one watchman that had, you know, it's a fairly, you know, it was an L-shaped building, and the watchman could easily have be at the other end while they did their damage. They could have been more specific. So guessing at his motives, my idea is that he wanted to leave a smoking hole in the ground. He didn't want to kill anybody, but he wanted to do some real serious damage, and he didn't care if it was astronomy, physics, or the Army Math Research Center, just as long as it was big. And he was smart enough to know where to park this thing, and he's also smart enough to know how to put together such a huge bomb. So it was very, I don't mean to be, make an ironic understatement, but it was very ham-fisted. It was very crude. So I don't really fully understand his motives or his background. But like I say, I was very ignorant myself about the entire civil disobedience and how it operates, or how it should operate in the best of situations.
How closely did you follow the aftermath in terms of them, you know, indicting the Carl and Dwight and Leo and David and their captures and trials?
I read whatever came out in the press. Some of that was confusing. I know that Carlton Armstrong's trial was a media event with some celebrities and so on. I did not attend any of that whatsoever. I thought that was strange. My personal explanation for that is it was, I think, what was he caught, 3 or 4 years after?
Yes, 2 years, 1972.
The war may have been over by that time. I'm not really sure. In other words, I felt that they're trying to recreate the polarization and pressure and tension and drama of the situation at that time. Mm-hmm. That would provoke people into such an extreme act, because in retrospect, it looked really bad in terms of the anti-war movement. And I don't know how that played out in the rest of the public. I don't know what, you know, what my family was thinking or anything else about. I don't know how it played out in the press far away from campus, you know, any campus anywhere. And I don't really know how the distant media think about it. If you go on a forum today, you can still find Madison bombing being talked about, and there are extremist statements made, and it's always against the student protesters. The entire student protester activity has been marginalized by the right. You can imagine how Fox News would handle this, you know, today. So I thought that with Jane Fonda and the rest of the celebrities coming to talk, they're trying to recreate the world that Carlton lived in to make this kind of a decision. Mm-hmm. But I'm not sure, you know, just to create the atmosphere, the background for it, the backstory of how people would make those decisions.
Yeah. Well, they all, the three bombers that were caught, they all pled. Mm-hmm. So the you know, Carl didn't actually have a trial. What
right.
he had was a 2-week sentencing hearing.
Yes.
Where they brought all kinds of people, celebrities and non-celebrities, all brought by the defense to sort of put the war on trial rather than
right.
to,
yes.
to try
Thank
to
you.
Justify
yeah, that's a good
his actions and his decisions. And of course, by the time his brother Dwight and David Fine were caught in 1976, they were very quick things and very simple, and they received far shorter sentences than Carl.
Right. Yes, that's true.
So much time had passed that people had different attitudes about it, for whatever reason.
Yes, yeah.
I was
subpoenaed to testify in the David Fine trial, and I guess he had a plea bargain instead. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And that was going to be in Milwaukee. That was a change in venue.
Mm-hmm. Did you know any of them at all?
No.
Not even by name? You didn't?
No.
They weren't
I'm vaguely aware of the New Year's gang, mm-hmm. but I don't know if it was Kaleidoscope or Takeover, those magazines were so painful to read in a way. Their attitude was good, but like I said, it was a political movement put together by 20-year-olds, and it was, you know, full of slogans, and essentially we had people, I don't know how to put this, middle-class college students taking up the cause of working men, and they tried to present it sort of as a labor movement. And the articles were extremely silly almost, and extreme. I guess to get copy, and the media does the same thing today. You know, if it bleeds, it leads. You know, so they took extreme positions on a lot of stuff.
Can I ask then about your thoughts and opinions about the campus newspaper at the time, the Daily Cardinal? Was that something you read, followed?
I was aware of it, looked at it once in a while, but no, I did not follow that.
You talked about when you were being questioned, there were students in there who had Kroger grins, and that comes from the bombing,
yes,
the firebombing of the Kroger, which was April, May 1970, right around the time of
right.
Nixon bringing the war to Cambodia, and then
yes.
also the Kent State
yes.
shooting.
Yes, yes.
You said you weren't, you know, specifically involved in protest per se, but I wonder if you have thoughts about those few weeks on campus, because I think those, let's just say people have who were living through it have some very strong memories about what was going on.
Yeah, I was already working working the night shift at that time, so I my hours, I'd come get up in the afternoon and be exposed to some of this stuff, but I was I would say I was for the most part apolitical. I mean, I was opposed to the war, but I still didn't understand how getting beat up by a cop would stop it. I couldn't bring myself to throw bricks through the windows of abandoned houses. There'd be these groups of people that would, they called it trashing, and they, once the riot started, they would try to break up buildings around them. I could not hold Oscar Rennebaum responsible for the war in Vietnam and break the windows of his stores or something like that. And yet I was surrounded by people who did and had a good time with it, you know. And so there was a certain theater and a certain childishness to the anti-war movement. And there were older, reasonable voices. I think the Progressive magazine is published in Madison. Mm-hmm. You know, and they were concerned with civil rights and women's rights and so on. And there were older voices, but that sobriety was drowned out, you know, by the activities of the undergraduates, you know, and the 20-year-olds. And it was theatrical when I came here, you know, with that. There was always this confrontation, and there was always this frat, not exactly a frat party, but a little bit of a frat party out of control atmosphere to a lot of these activities. And I wasn't any more mature than the rest of them, but I was a little bit alienated from that. I couldn't see throwing something at a policeman. I couldn't see physically attacking a policeman. There were protest leaders. There were, you know, there was a series of really huge marches that took place, and we were on. Well, there's a post office where there used to be a McDonald's. You'd be sitting in a restaurant near a campus, ordinary situation, and the police would break in, grab somebody and drag them out the door. Or you'd be sitting in Glen and Ann's, which is now the Nitty Gritty, and all of a sudden a woman would get up, I've forgotten her name, she was an undercover police detective, and take a picture of the crowd and then leave really quickly before people realized what had happened and who she was.
She needed an informant or a cop?
She was a cop. Hmm. So they had targeted certain protest leaders on campus, and maybe they, meaning the police, and maybe they thought they had documented facts, you know, of them doing destructive acts, and so they could bring them to trial or something like that and try and shut down, you know, some of this activity. In some sense, you have to feel sorry for the Madison police because they had to be held, they were being held responsible for the Vietnam War, and this is, you know, there are 30,000 students on this campus. So even the football games, I mean, long before things became political, just the Friday nights before the football games would get really strange. I think the fraternity parties, there was a tradition of throwing the bartenders out through the windows of the Var Bar on Stay Street. So I stayed back. I'm a little guy for the Madison campus, and I stayed back from a lot of that. I'd be the guy going through the window, you know. So I stayed back. So there was all of this. I mean, this was the number one party school long before it became political. And they were proud of their Playboy would survey or something like that. I don't know if that was a recruitment tool or not, but it was a fact that the Madison police had to deal with. So there's a big disconnect.
Do you think that you, being a native Wisconsinite, you can tell I'm not, had something to do with your view about, you know, the people coming here from other parts of the country?
Oh, and absolutely, yeah.
They had different values and different...
They had more consumable income, and they had a much better preparation. You know, they were, for some, there were giant remedial classes to teach us how to write essays and so on, and there are very few out-of-state people in those classes. There'd be a big test at the beginning of semester, and then the folks, the adults who were going to college would be separated off, and they could move ahead. And the rest of us had essentially remedial kind of stuff. And then there was also a Darwinian process going on. I mean, we were told during orientation, look left and right, and half the people you see will not be here by the time of their senior year, and that was true. So the answer to accepting everybody from the high schools is that 50% of us eliminated ourselves by not being mature enough to handle it. And so the campus was crazy. There'd be people driving cars on the lake and so on. I mean, there you know, on weekends, I mean, there was something out of control someplace all the time. And then with the hippie thing coming in, I remember the San Francisco Mime Troupe being here, and they would put on activities all over the campus, and you'd see these people dressed up. There was a pedestrian bridge over Park Street right outside the Union, and they were up there like gargoyles for a while. As I mentioned, one afternoon you had your choice between the free rock concert or the riot. You know, you had your or you could do both. You could go back and forth. You know, and you could buy food concessions in between and go to the bathrooms. You could make a whole day of it. You know, it was almost like a theme park for a while. I mean, it was.
The mime group was here during the Dow riot.
Yes. Yes.
Do you have any memories of the Dow riot?
I was not out on the. I did not take part in that. I heard about it afterwards, and I remember people talking about it. And there was a great deal of anger and tension afterwards, and I think the police escalated the violence from that point on. So what I know about the Dow riot is what you folks know about it, looking at it back through the media.
Okay. There's another voice in here. She's been.
No, I was just going to remind you. We saw 2 days in October.
Right.
On PBS. Was that the Dow? That was.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Yep, that's Dow.
Juxtaposed against what was going on in Vietnam.
Right.
That's all.
Yeah, that's. They may have taken that from. I always pronounce his name wrong. Oh. Marinus or Moranis's
right.
Book.
His book.
Which is They
Marched
into Sunlight.
Yeah. Yeah.
Which he juxtaposes the Wisconsin. Those Wisconsin folks that are fighting Vietnam.
Right.
With the protests here. Yep. It's a very good book.
So, I want to make sure I've asked everything. So you said you left and you didn't stay involved in the rebuilding of Sterling Hall, but did you even tangentially sort of understand the amount of research that was destroyed because of...
I didn't have a full appreciation of that until I read the same books that you folks have read. I didn't know even exactly what Fosnock had been working on.
So to fast forward, and we may have other questions too, but when we were walking in here well before the recorder was on, you said you were here from 63 to 79. So why 79 is the time to finally leave the area?
I had given up on technology for a career, and I had tried to make a living as a luthier building guitars, and I couldn't do that. I had a family to support, so I took my degree and went running with my tail between my legs, to go to work. And the National Electrostatics was growing at that time, so I was hired as a vacuum technician and assembled vacuum pumps and built apparatus, built the research apparatus for the president of the company, because I had machine shop skills and woodworking skills and so on. I could put together his little gizmos and run experiments pretty quickly. Then I parlayed, while I was there, I discovered, when I saw these physicists try to build a communication system based on optics to talk to the electronics that's up there at 25 million volts. They built really huge machines there in Middleton. I realized that I knew something about optics because I had been an amateur astronomer in high school and had built a telescope, and everything I'd read about optics stuck. One of the people on the staff there generously loaned me then some optics textbooks, and I'd go through those things in 2 days from cover to cover. I mean, all of that, it's a very graphic way of thinking, and all of that just fell into place. I segued over to the physical sciences laboratory, which is a combination of both vacuum and optics. So I got in there and fabricated optics for them. That's an electron storage ring, and that's down in Stoughton. And that's a team of research physicists as well, working for the National Science Foundation mostly. Absolutely fascinating place. And I was there for 2 years long enough to put engineer on my resume and optics, and then I signed up with a headhunter and had interviews on the East Coast, Xerox and Perkin-Elmer and General Electric, to become a proper optical engineer. So I had discovered engineering at National Electrostatics and discovered that I could do optics, and all of a sudden I had a career track that made sense to me, and it has worked out pretty well for me ever since.
So was it in 79 that you got a job in the East Coast, and that's
right,
when you...
Right,
and that was with GE, you mentioned earlier.
That's right, General Electric.
Mike, what else do you...
I just thought maybe we could look at some pictures.
Yeah, okay. If you don't mind looking
no,
at some...
No, that's it.
If you want, I might actually move over there.
Okay, yeah.
Sure.
Do you want me to move?
So this is one of the, again, sort of the iconic pictures
post-bombing. Right.
There are no... Right.
I'll use this as a pointer, but...
There are no windows in the building.
Right, right. Yeah, and this facade has been totally rebuilt, but this is the ramp going down there, and of course the van was parked right there, and that's the loading dock.
Uh-huh.
And that's the hole I crawl out of right there at the end.
Okay.
The trees, this was grass, and the trees were here. There were pine trees, and I guess the plasma, the ball of flame, this is seven stories, was way up there. And that's parts of that wood and or the truck were blown inside, and that's what was burning the first time I went into that room.
So it had blown the tree that way?
Well, it was all mixed up. I mean,
And the MG you were driving was parked across.
Would be back here, yeah. Right.
Okay.
Right. So now this is all changed. It's all been brought up a level to here. You don't have these steps now.
Right.
It's all elevated and rebuilt. So they used bolt cutters and took down, it was a post, I think, that they... It would be unlocked and folded over for trucks to deliver things to the laboratory down there. And so this is how they got in. You know, they cut that with bolt cutters and drove the van on down there. And I'd learned that from reading the book. So that's a direct view probably from where the van was parked, and Fasnacht would have been over here.
In the lower.
And Schuster was back there in the hall someplace.
And you were down a level.
And if this is not the basement level, I would be on this level. But yes, I was in the basement. I would have been over here.
Okay. Oh, okay. I see what you're saying. Yeah.
So if you think of it as an L-shaped building, there's parts of the floor plan that are essentially underground and outside the building, and that's
right.
And surrounded by heavy concrete, and that's where this research lab was.
So if we were to look at this.
Oh, okay.
Now map, schematic.
Right. That's the wall that was. That's where the fire extinguisher was supposed to be. This is where I sat.
So this is that you're talking about B540 there, I think is the
right.
Remember, this is a map from the time that David Schuster used to explain where he was in the building.
Right, he would have been over here. This is his where his apparatus was. This was the accelerator,
okay.
And the big magnet was at this corner here. And here's the loading dock. So,
right.
And there's a doorway.
The truck would have been right here.
Yes.
Okay.
So you're pointing to the triangle part that's
right.
This is all.
Okay.
So this is the accelerator room here.
Right. And this was kind of a utility room with circuit breakers, and that was the place that had the fire extinguisher, and part of that wall was blown away.
Okay, so and the triangle is underground, and so the
yeah,
van
absolutely.
Was under.
The van was right here.
Okay,
at the same level, actually, because this ramp goes down low enough.
Right. And David Schuster has a note on this map. The red circle marks the area where I last saw Fasnacht standing on the corridor, which is right
okay.
there.
Yeah.
So he was up a level.
Yeah. No, was he? I think Schuster was at the basement. Fasnacht was in the basement, and this either this room or this room was his lab, with the windows covered over with aluminum foil.
And where would have like Paul Quinn been sitting? Where was
one
his office?
One floor up above,
okay.
And
somewhere over there.
Yes.
Hmm.
Right, and.
And Schuster's office would have been up there too, or would it have been?
You know, he was working here, but I'm not sure where his office would have been. And while he's working, you know, he's there full time, and
right.
You know, capturing data with all that stuff that they put together.
This must have been taken
Must be one of the early pictures.
Yeah. That's right.
Fire, it's still sort of dark.
Fire trucks did arrive, and right. And there may have been fires inside. That's the astronomy department up there. Mm-hmm.
Roger, you left before the fire trucks arrived, though?
Yes.
Okay.
I basically didn't know what to do with myself. And
How far was your walk back to your house? Because obviously the MG was a little... damaged.
Yeah.
It doesn't matter.
You're living on Park Street, or?
Let's see.
Pine Street?
It was either Gorham or Gilman. It was one of those.
Okay. So a decent walk, but not.
Right.
Not miles and miles.
No. 4 or 5 blocks. I'd have to look at a street map, but it's one of those diagonal streets that joins up with the university, and there's,
okay. So this is another.
This is just a picture of the
right.
structure they put in to hold the building up while they were rebuilding. And this is the same area that we saw in this other photo,
right.
I think.
Right.
Sort of taken from the area that you walked out of. Is that right?
Yes.
Okay.
So these holes are the cinder block walls that were simply blown away because they weren't strong enough.
Mm-hmm.
And this has been removed.
Right,
the bomb didn't do that. They're restabilizing the building,
right.
And this may have been added. You know, so
okay.
they decided how to secure the building and then rebuild the stuff down here, keep it in one piece.
Well, I think this is just a. Is this a picture from across the street?
That's from the chemistry.
You could sit here.
That's from the chemistry building. Well, it was the chemistry building at that time. Looking down, you know, so right, the van would have been under there.
So is this now, we're about on our sixth picture now. Again, this
is... Yeah, it's SO4245.
Okay. And we are looking, where's the shot taken from? One of the buildings across, is that chemistry?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Second or third floor.
These are all pictures from
right,
you.
Right.
You've got all these pictures.
Oh, and they're all sequential too. That's good.
Yeah.
So they're all in the SO4243
exactly.
Area, 4200s basically.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay. Gotcha. All right, so more.
Now that I think was that Schuster's car?
That might be a shot of Schuster's.
Yeah, because you can see the MG right there.
Right.
All right, so that's a different angle of the Schuster car.
I'm not sure why this is in there.
I think that's just showing the damage from far away. These greenhouses aren't close.
That's correct. And I think parts of the motor flew over those greenhouses. There's a little bit of a park, a area, horticultural park, an arboretum or something, tiny little half a block arboretum mm-hmm. off of University. And I think, from what I read in the books, they found parts of the motor in there, and they were able to identify the serial number of the motor. Also parts of the motor up on the roof of top of Burge Hall.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so that would be chemistry. No, I'm not really sure where this is.
Yeah.
Yes, that would be chemistry, because there was a walkway between the two buildings. That's exactly right. So that's chemistry. This is Sterling Hall. That ramp. And that van is down here, and you're looking beyond the Burge Hall, which is the Botany Building at that mm-hmm. time. So this is taken from a driveway from the hospital.
Right. Okay. Yeah.
At that time.
SO4250 picture that is that you're talking about.
I'm guessing that's Burge Hall, but I'm not sure. Okay, that's the end of Sterling Hall, and so that laboratory that you see is all under this ground here.
Oh, okay. That's where the triangle is. I see.
Yes.
Okay.
And so this is a view to the southwest.
So SO4252 shows
right.
us.
And that's, you know, these two floors are astronomy, you know, and then this was the Army Math Research Center, and this would be the physics people. These here, and possibly down one floor below that. So Paul Quinn must have been at this level, I think.
So what we consider to be the first floor.
The
ground floor, the entrance.
Yeah.
Yeah, from that side of the building is like two levels above the entrance from Charter Street. You know, I mean, there's a hill. This is
right.
Bascom Hill. This is the southwest corner of Bascom Hill coming down here.
Just see it in the background back there. It looks like
right.
they've already got some work done.
Yeah.
Right. Right.
At that point.
That might be Barshall, I am not sure.
So clean up this picture of what might be Barshall. It's probably somebody in the physics department cleaning up what looks like an office.
Mm-hmm. And these are just,
again,
a series
more inside,
of some interior shots of the damage.
An external shot here, 4256.
Yeah, and I don't fully
I can't
understand.
Now
that I cannot.
Chemistry, or is
That could be some other building or some other side of this building, or.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of these shots, I think, are just to show the damage that's
like
done to
windows
other.
Windows blown out.
Right.
Damage
so this,
done to other buildings.
Or this could even be part of the hospital across the street. I am not sure.
Mm-hmm.
But it doesn't look like Sterling.
No.
Another shot from a distance. Showing multiple buildings that have windows, at least one, two, three, four, that have windows blown out.
Right.
Okay.
Their interior shot.
Mm-hmm. I can't tell what that is.
No, just damaged desks and so on.
And so the large computers, looks like at least four giant computers there.
And we're back down in the basement, because there's actually stuff removed.
Damage on the inside. Now, is this, does this look familiar to you, this room?
No.
This is 4265.
There is some sort of balcony here. I am not sure. This could be in the chemistry building. I'm not really sure, or...
Yeah, I think a lot of these shots again are to show
something pumping station, gas handling and pumping station.
Oh, yep.
No, we would not have that in our research lab, so that is chemistry or some other building.
Okay. You remember this being on the outside of the building?
No, I do not.
Okay, so this is 4266, a poster put up by the physics faculty, post-Sterling Hall bombing. More internal damage.
Right, and this could be any one of a number of buildings.
Right.
Although, if you back that one up...
Oops, this one, or this one?
Yeah, I think that's a spot welding machine. I'm not sure, so I'm guessing these are the physicists, if they have something like that.
Okay.
There are people who will be able to identify that.
Mm-hmm.
Microscope, it's got a cover over it, so that it still could be chemistry.
Mm-hmm. This is, I think, the last one, which is just sort of a close-up of the ramp area.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And then, do we have, I didn't see it, did we go by the picture that shows the MG and Schuster's van? There we go.
This one.
So that's...
5279.
SO5279.
Right.
So this is the MG closest right. to us in the picture. That's what you drove there.
Right.
But it wasn't yours.
No, it was borrowed.
But you tell it... I think it was before the recorder was on, you told the story about how you still drove that around at
yes.
least a little bit afterwards.
Yes, I drove it around in that condition to a body shop. We got estimates and then left it with a body shop.
Okay. Did you have to, was there debris and stuff?
Yes, yes, I had.
And I assume the loot was...
I think I recovered that same morning, but I'm not sure.
Okay.
And it was quite broken up. It took me a few months to fix it. And my roommate was pretty understanding about the whole thing.
How long did you keep that loot?
It was delivered to a friend of his in Pennsylvania, I think a year or two later, so by 72 that was gone. He left and I think has lived in Europe ever since. My roommate out in Poinette, and he left, I think, after approximately 9 months or so. And I think has made a living in Paris or something like that. We've lost track of him since then.
Roger, I knew Dwayne.
Right.
So he didn't leave 9 months after the bombing.
Maybe it was a year and 9 months. I know that he left in the
spring.
I think you're right.
Dwayne was... So he was a roommate.
Out in Poinette, yes.
Poinette.
Okay. Right.
Roger, is there anything else we try to give you the last word. Is there anything else you want to say about this time period, the bombing itself, anything you want to get off your chest, so to speak?
No, I'd mentioned about the survivor's guilt, about being very conscious of Fasnacht and his family, and you know, and they're just, we're lovely people, lovely looking people, and it's a loss. You know, and I probably feel more sensitive to that, becoming a family man myself, you know, and I can imagine, you know, what happens and how they, and I think as Mrs. Fasnacht probably did a very strong job of getting on with her life and raising those children. And I think they have successful careers and family is okay, you know. But that's what sticks in my mind. When I juxtapose that against the nonsense rhetoric coming out of those magazines and what you hear on the streets and phrases like kill the pig and all the rest of that, it's frustrating, you know, that, the only thing I can think of is that a political movement put together by 20-year-olds, you know, the simplistic thinking in a way.
All right, Mike, do you have anything else?
So how many kids do you have?
I have two children. They're both scientists.
Uh-huh.
And doing research in medicine. And Ellen has had a career as a teacher, and I basically had a career as an aerospace and defense engineer.
Yeah, I don't think I have any other questions. Whether it's on the record or not, I mean, I'd be interested to hear your thoughts after you watch the DVD of the reading
that
we did
in
March.
Sure, yeah.
You know, if you want to send me your thoughts in an email or give me a call and we can talk about it, if anything, you know, you have your impressions of it or that, I would love to hear them.
Sure.
So.
I have some silly questions that maybe should be off the record.
Okay. All right, well then let's...
There is a Wisconsin accent. I don't know how well you guys handle that with your actors. I mean,
I want to thank you for your time before we start digressing into Wisconsin accents. Roger, thank you very much
well, thank
for your
you.
Time today. We appreciate it.